haven't always gotten along so very well. Before Rune got ill, he was the head of the Residents Association, and before that, Uwe was the head. And when Rune was voted in, there was something of a wrangle between Uwe and Rune, you could say. Uwe looks up and points a corrective index finger at her.
A coup d'etat, that's what it was.
Rune's wife nods at Parvana.
Well, yes, well, before the meeting, Rune counted votes about his suggestion that we should change the heating system for the houses, and Uwe thought...
And what the hell does Rune know about heating systems, eh?
Uwe exclaims heatedly, but immediately gets a look from Parvana, which makes him reconsider and come to the conclusion that there's no need to complete his line of thought. Rune's wife nods.
Maybe you're right, Uwe, but anyway, he's very sick now, so it doesn't really matter anymore.
Her bottom lip trembles slightly. Then she regains her composure, straightens her neck with dignity, and clears her throat.
The authorities have said they'll take him from me and put him in a home, she manages to say.
Uwe puts his hands in his pockets again and determinedly backs away across his threshold.
He's heard enough of this.
In the meantime, the lanky one seems to have decided it's time to change the subject and lighten up the atmosphere. He points at the floor in Uva's hall.
What's that?
Uwe turns to look at the bit of floor exposed by the loose plastic sheet.
It looks as if you've got sort of tire marks on the floor. Do you cycle indoors or what?
Says the lanky one. Parvana keeps her observant eyes on Uwe as he backs away another step, so he can impede the lanky one's view.
It's nothing.
But I can see it's...
The lanky one begins confusedly.
It was Uva's wife, Sonia. She was...
Rune's wife interrupts him in a friendly manner, but she only has time to get to the name Sonia when Uwe, in turn, interrupts her and spins around with unbridled fury in his eyes.
That'll do. Now you shut up.
All four of them fall silent, equally shocked. Uwe's hands tremble as he steps back into his hall and slams the door. He hears Parvana's soft voice out there asking Rune's wife what all that was about. Then he hears Rune's wife fumbling nervously for words, and then exclaiming,
Oh, you know, I'd better go home. That thing about Uwe's wife...
Oh, forget it. Old bats like me. We talk too much, you know?
Uwe hears her strained laugh and then her little dragging footsteps disappearing as quickly as they can around the corner of his shed. A moment later, the pregnant one and the lanky one also leave. And all that's left is the silence of Uva's hall. He sinks down on the stool, breathing heavily. His hands are still shaking as if he were standing waist-deep in ice-cold water. His chest thumps. It happens more and more these days. He has to sort of struggle for a mouthful of air like a fish in an overturned bowl. His company doctor said it was chronic and that he mustn't work himself up. Easy for him to say.
Good to go home and have a rest now, said his bosses at work. Now your heart is playing up and all.
They called it early retirement, but they might as well have said what it was, liquidation. A third of a century in the same job, and that's what they reduced him to. Uwe is not sure how long he stays there on the stool, sitting with the drill in his hand and his heart beating so hard that he feels the pulse inside his head. There's a photo on the wall beside the front door of Uwe and Sonia. It's almost 40 years old, that time they were in Spain on a bus tour. She's suntanned, wearing a red dress and looking so happy. Uwe is standing next to her, holding her hand. He sits there for what must be an hour, just staring at that photo. Of all the imaginable things he most misses about her, the thing he really wishes he could do again is hold her hand in his. She had a way of folding her index finger into his palm, hiding it inside. And he always felt that nothing in the world was impossible when she did that. Of all the things he could miss, that's what he misses most. Slowly he stands up, goes into the living room, up the steps of the stool, and then, once and for all, he drills the hole and puts in the hook, then gets off the stool and studies his work.
He goes into the hall and puts on his suit jacket, feels in his pocket for the envelope. He's turned out all the lights, washed his coffee mug, put up a hook in his living room. He's done. He takes down the rope from the clothes dryer in the hall. Gently, with the back of his hand, he caresses her coats one last time. Then he goes into the living room, ties a noose in the rope, threads it through the hook, climbs up on the stool, and puts his head in the noose. Kicks the stool away. Closes his eyes and feels the noose closing around his throat like the jaws of a large wild animal. Chapter 8. A man who was Uwe, and a pair of his father's old footprints. She believed in destiny. That all the roads you walk in life, in one way or another, lead to what has been predetermined for you. Uwe, of course, just started muttering under his breath and got very busy fiddling about with a screw or something whenever she started going on like this. But he never disagreed with her. Maybe to her, destiny was something. That was none of his business. But to him, destiny was someone. It's a strange thing, becoming an orphan at 16, to lose your family long before you've had time to create your own, to replace it. It's a very specific sort of loneliness. Uwe, conscientious and dutiful, completed his 2-week stint on the railways. And to his own surprise, he found that he liked it. There was a certain liberation in doing a job, grabbing hold of things with his own 2 hands and seeing the fruit of his efforts. Uwe hadn't ever disliked school, but he hadn't quite seen the point of it either. He liked mathematics and was 2 academic years ahead of his classmates. As for the other subjects, quite honestly, he was not so concerned about them. But this was something entirely different, something that suited him much better. When he clocked off from his last shift on the last day, he was downcast, not only because he had to go back to school, but because it had only occurred to him now that he didn't know how to earn a living. Dad had been good in many ways, of course, but Uwe had to admit he hadn't left much of an estate except a run-down house, an old Saab, and a dented wristwatch. Alms from the church were out of the question. God should be bloody clear about that. Uwe said as much to himself while he stood there in the changing rooms, maybe as much for his own benefit as God's. "If you really had to take both Mom and Dad, keep your bloody money," he yelled up at the ceiling. Then he packed up his stuff and left. Whether God or anyone else was listening, he never found out. But when Uwe came out of the changing rooms, a man from the managing director's office was standing there waiting for him. "Uwe?" he asked. Uwe nodded. "The director would like to express his thanks for doing such a good job over the past fortnight," the man said, short and to the point. "Thanks," said Uwe as he started walking away. The man put his hand on Uwe's arm. Uwe stopped. "The director was wondering whether you might have an interest in staying and carrying on doing a good job." Uwe stood in silence, looking at the man. Maybe mostly to check if this was some kind of joke. Then he slowly nodded. When he'd taken a few more steps, the man called out behind him, "The director says you're just like your father." Uwe didn't turn around, but his back was straighter as he walked off. And that's how he ended up in his father's old boots. He worked hard, never complained, and was never ill. The old boys on his shift found him a little on the quiet side and a little odd on top of that. He never wanted to join them for a beer after work, and he seemed uninterested in women as well, which was more than weird in its own right. But he was a chip off the old block and had never given them anything to complain about. If anyone asked Uwe for a hand, he got on with it. If anyone asked him to cover a shift for them, he did it without any fuss. As time went by, more or less, all of them owed him a favor or two, so they accepted him. When the old truck, the one they used to drive up and down the railway track, broke down one night more than 10 miles outside of town, in one of the worst downpours of the whole year, Uwe managed to repair it with nothing but a screwdriver and half a roll of gauze tape. After that, as far as the old boys on the tracks were concerned, Uwe was okay. In the evenings, he'd boil his sausages and potatoes, staring out the kitchen window as he ate. And the next morning, he'd go to work again. He liked the routine, liked always knowing what to expect. Since his father's death, he had begun more and more to differentiate between people who did what they should and those who didn't. People who did, and people who just talked. Uwe talked less and less and did more and more. He had no friends, but on the other hand, he hardly had any enemies either, apart from Tom, who since his promotion to foreman took every opportunity to make Uwe's life as difficult as possible. He gave him the dirtiest and heaviest jobs, shouted at him, tripped him up at breakfast, sent him under railway carriages for inspections, and sent them in motion while Uwe lay unprotected on the cross ties. When Uwe, startled, threw himself out of the way just in time, Tom laughed contemptuously and roared, "Look out, or you'll end up like your old man!" Uwe kept his head down, though, and his mouth shut. He saw no purpose in challenging a man who was twice his own size. He went to work every day and did justice to himself. That had been good enough for his father, and so it would also have to do for Uwe. His colleagues learned to appreciate him for it. "When people don't talk so much, they don't dish out the crap either," one of his older workmates said to him one afternoon down on the track, and Uwe nodded. Some got it, and some didn't. There were also some who got what Uwe ended up doing one day in the director's office, while others didn't. It was almost 2 years after his father's funeral. Uwe had just turned 18. Tom had been caught out stealing money from the cash box in one of the carriages. Admittedly, no one but Uwe saw him take it, but Tom and Uwe had been the only two people in the carriage when the money went missing. And, as a serious man from the director's office explained when Tom and Uwe were ordered to present themselves, no one could believe Uwe was the guilty party. And he wasn't, of course. Uwe was left on a wooden chair in the corridor outside the director's office. He sat there looking at the floor for 15 minutes before the door opened. Tom stepped outside, his fists so clenched with determination that his skin was bloodless and white on his lower arms. He kept trying to make eye contact with Uwe. Uwe just kept staring down at the floor until he was brought into the director's office. More serious men in suits were spread around the room. The director himself was pacing back and forth behind his desk, his face highly colored, and there was an insinuation that he was too angry to stand still. "You want to sit down, Uwe?" said one of the men in suits at last. Uwe met his gaze and knew who he was. His dad had mended his car once, a blue Opel Manta with the big engine. He smiled amicably at Uwe and gestured cursorily at a chair in the middle of the floor, as if to let him know that he was among friends now and could relax. Uwe shook his head. The Opel Manta man nodded with understanding. "Well then, this is just a formality, Uwe. No one in here believes you took the money. All you need to do is tell us who did it." Uwe looked down at the floor. Half a minute passed. "Uwe?" Uwe didn't answer. The harsh voice of the director broke the silence at long last. "Answer the question, Uwe." Uwe stood in silence, looking down at the floor. The facial expressions of the men in suits shifted from conviction to slight confusion. "Uwe, you do understand that you have to answer the question. Did you take the money?" "No," said Uwe with a steady voice. "So, who was it?" Uwe stood in silence. "Answer the question," ordered the director. Uwe looked up, stood there with a straight back. "I'm not the sort that tells tales about what other people do," he said. The room was steeped in silence for what must have been several minutes. "You do understand, Uwe, that if you don't tell us who it was, and if we have one or more witnesses who say it was you, then we'll have to draw the conclusion that it was you," said the director, not as amicable now. Uwe nodded but didn't say another word. The director scrutinized him as if he were a bluffer in a game of cards. Uwe's face was unmoved. The director nodded grimly. "So, you can go then." And Uwe left. Tom had put the blame on Uwe when he was in the director's office some 15 minutes earlier. During the afternoon, two of the younger men from Tom's shift, eager as young men are to earn the approval of older men, came forward and claimed that they had seen Uwe take the money with their own eyes. If Uwe had pointed out Tom, it would have been one word against another. But now, it was Tom's word against Uwe's silence. The next morning, he was told by the foreman to empty his locker and present himself outside the director's office. Tom stood inside the door of the changing rooms and jeered at him as he was leaving.
"Thief!" hissed Tom.
Uwe passed him without raising his eyes.
"Thief, thief, thief!"
One of their younger colleagues, who had testified against Uwe, chanted happily across the changing room, until one of the older men on their shift gave him a slap across the ear that silenced him.
"Thief!"
Tom shouted demonstratively, so loudly that the word was still ringing in Uwe's head several days after. Uwe walked out into the morning air without turning around. He took a deep breath. He was furious, but not because they had called him a thief. He would never be the sort of man who cared what other men called him. But the shame of losing a job to which his father had devoted his whole life burned like a red-hot poker in his breast. He had plenty of time to think his life over as he walked one last time to the office, a bundle of work clothes clutched in his arms. He had liked working here. Proper tasks, proper tools, a real job. He decided that once the police had gone through the motions of whatever they did with thieves in this situation, he'd try to go somewhere where he could get himself another job, like this one. He might have to travel far, he imagined. Most likely a criminal record needed a reasonable geographical distance before it started to pale and become uninteresting. He had nothing to keep him here, he realized. But at least he had not become the sort of man who told tales. He hoped this would make his father more forgiving about Uwe losing his job once they were reunited. He had to sit on the wooden chair in the corridor for almost 40 minutes before a middle-aged woman in a tight-fitting black skirt and pointy glasses came and told him he could come into the office. She closed the door behind him. He stood there, still with his work clothes in his arms. The director sat behind his desk with his hands clasped together in front of him. The two men submitted one another to such a long examination that either of them could have been an unusually interesting painting in a museum. "It was Tom who took that money," said the director. He did not say it as a question, just a short confirming statement. Uwe didn't answer. The director nodded. "But the men in your family are not the kind who tell." That was not a question either, and Uwe didn't reply. The director noticed that he straightened a little at the words, "the men in your family." The director nodded again. Put on a pair of glasses, looked through a pile of papers, and started writing something. As if in that very moment, Uwe had disappeared from the room. Uwe stood in front of him for so long that he quite seriously began to doubt whether the director was aware of his presence. The director looked up.
"Yes?
Men are what they are because of what they do, not what they say," said Uwe. The director looked at him with surprise. It was the longest sequence of words anyone at the railway depot had heard the boy say since he started working there 2 years ago. In all honesty, Uwe did not know where they came from. He just felt they had to be said. The director looked down at his pile of papers again, wrote something there, pushed a piece of paper across the desk, pointed to where Uwe should sign his name. "This is a declaration that you have voluntarily given up your job," he said. Uwe signed his name, straightened up with something unyielding in his face. "You can tell them to come in now. I'm ready."
"Who?"
asked the director. "The police," said Uwe, clenching his fists at his sides. The director shook his head briskly and went back to digging in his pile of papers. "I actually think the witness testimonies have been lost in this mess." Uwe moved his weight from one foot to the other without really knowing how to respond to this. The director waved his hand without looking at him. "You're free to go now." Uwe turned around, went into the corridor, closed the door behind him, felt
lightheaded. Just as he reached the front door, the woman who had first let him in caught up with energetic steps, and before he had time to protest, she pressed a paper into his hands. "The director wants you to know that you're hired as a night cleaner on the long-distance train. Report to the foreman there tomorrow morning," she said sternly. Uwe stared at her, then at the paper. She leaned in closer. "The director asked me to pass on another message. You did not take that wallet when you were 9 years old, and he'll be deuced if you took anything now. And it will be a damn pity for him to be responsible for kicking a decent man's son into the street just because the son has some principles." And so it turned out that Uwe became a night cleaner instead. And if this hadn't happened, he never would have come off his shift that morning and caught sight of her, with those red shoes and the gold brooch and all her burnished brown hair and that laughter of hers, which, for the rest of his life, would make him feel as if someone was running around barefoot on the inside of his breast. She often said that all roads lead to something you were always predestined to do. And for her, perhaps, it was something. But for Uwe, it was someone. Chapter 9. A man called Uwe bleeds a radiator. They say the brain functions quicker while it's falling, as if the sudden explosion of kinetic energy forces the mental faculties to accelerate until the perception of the exterior world goes into slow motion. So Uwe had time to think of many different things, mainly radiators. Because there are right and wrong ways of doing things, as we all know, and even though it was many years ago and Uwe could no longer remember exactly what solution he'd considered to be the right one in the argument about which central heating system should be adopted by the Residents Association, he did remember very clearly that Rune's approach to it had been wrong. But it wasn't just the central heating system. Rune and Uwe had known one another for almost 40 years, and they had been at loggerheads for at least 37 of them. Uwe could not in all honesty remember how it all started. It wasn't the sort of dispute where you did remember. It was more of an argument where the little disagreements had ended up so entangled that every new word was treacherously booby-trapped, and in the end it wasn't possible to open one's mouth at all without setting off at least 4 unexploded mines from earlier conflicts. It was the sort of argument that had just run and run and run until one day it just ran out. It wasn't really about cars, properly speaking, but Uwe drove a Saab after all, and Rune drove a Volvo. Anyone could have seen it wouldn't work out in the long run. In the beginning, though, they had been friends. Or at least friends to the extent that men like Uwe and Rune were capable of being friends. Mostly for the sake of their wives, obviously. All 4 of them had moved into the area at the same time, and Sonia and Anita became instant best friends, as only women married to men like Uwe and Rune can be. Uwe recalled that he had at least not disliked Rune in those early years, as far as he could remember. They were the ones who set up the Residents Association, Uwe as chairman and Rune as assistant chairman. They had stuck together when the council wanted to cut down the forest behind Uwe's and Rune's houses in order to build even more houses. Of course, the council claimed that those construction plans had been there for years before Rune and Uwe moved into their houses. But one did not get far with Rune and Uwe using that sort of argumentation. "It's war, you bastards!" Rune had roared at them down the telephone line. And it truly was. Endless appeals and writs and petitions and letters to newspapers. 1.5 years later, the council gave up and started building somewhere else instead. That evening, Rune and Uwe had drunk a glass of whiskey each on Rune's patio. They didn't seem overly happy about winning, their wives pointed out. Both men were rather disappointed that the council had given up so quickly. These 18 months had been some of the most enjoyable of their lives. "Is no one prepared to fight for their principles anymore?" Rune had wondered. "Not a damn one," Uwe had answered. And then they said a toast to unworthy enemies. That was long before the coup d'etat in the Residents Association, of course, and before Rune bought a BMW. "Idiot,"
thought Uwe on that day. And also today, all these years after. And every day in between, actually. How the heck are you supposed to have a reasonable conversation with someone who buys a BMW? Uwe used to ask Sonia when she wondered why the two men could not have a reasonable conversation anymore. And at that point, Sonia used to find no other course but to roll her eyes while muttering, "You're hopeless." Uwe wasn't hopeless, in his own view. He just had a sense of there needing to be a bit of order in the greater scheme of things. He felt one should not go through life as if everything was exchangeable, as if loyalty was worthless. Nowadays, people change their stuff so often that any expertise in how to make things last was becoming superfluous. Quality? No one cared about that anymore. Not Rune or the other neighbors, and not those managers in the place where Uwe worked. Now, everything had to be computerized, as if one couldn't build a house until some consultant in a too-small shirt figured out how to open a laptop. As if that was how they built the Colosseum and the pyramids of Giza. Christ! They'd managed to build the Eiffel Tower in 1889, but nowadays one couldn't come up with the bloody drawings for a one-story house without taking a break for someone to run off and recharge their cell phone. This was a world where one became outdated before one's time was up. An entire country standing up and applauding the fact that no one was capable of doing anything properly anymore. The unreserved celebration of mediocrity. No one could change tires, install a dimmer switch, lay some tiles, plaster a wall, file their own taxes. These were all forms of knowledge that had lost their relevance. And the sorts of things Uwe had once spoken of with Rune. And then Rune went and bought a BMW. Was a person hopeless because he believed there should be some limits? Uwe didn't think so. And yes, he didn't exactly remember how that argument with Rune had started, but it had continued. It had been about radiators and central heating systems and parking slots and trees that had to be felled, and snow clearance and lawnmowers and rat poison in Rune's pond. For more than 35 years, they had paced about on their identical patios behind their identical houses, while throwing meaningful glares over the fence. And then, one day, about a year ago, it all came to an end. Rune became ill, never came out of the house anymore. Uwe didn't even know if he still had the BMW. And there was a part of him that missed that bloody old sod. So, as they say, the brain functions quicker when it's falling. Like thinking thousands of thoughts in a fraction of a second. In other words, Uwe has a good deal of time to think after he's kicked the stool over and fallen and landed on the floor with a lot of angry thrashing. He lies there on his back, looking up for what seems like half an eternity at the hook still up on the ceiling. Then in shock he stares at the rope, which has snapped into two long stumps. This society, thinks Uwe, can't they even manufacture rope anymore? He swears profusely while he furiously tries to untangle his legs. How can one fail to manufacture rope, for Christ's sake? How can you get rope wrong? No, there's no quality anymore, Uwe decides. He stands up, brushes himself down, peers around the room and ground floor of his row house, feels his cheeks burning. He's not quite sure if it's because of anger or shame. He looks at the window and the drawn curtains as if concerned that someone may have seen him. Isn't that bloody typical, he thinks? You can't even kill yourself in a sensible way anymore. He picks up the snapped rope and throws it in the kitchen wastebasket, folds up the plastic sheeting and puts it in the IKEA bags, puts back the hammer action drill and the drill bits in their cases, then goes out and puts everything back in the shed. He stands out there for a few minutes and thinks about how Sonia always used to nag at him to tidy the place up. He always refused, knowing that any new space would immediately be an excuse to go out and buy more useless stuff with which to fill it. And now it's too late for tidying, he confirms. Now there's no longer anyone who wants to go out and buy useless stuff. Now the tidying would just result in a lot of empty gaps. And Uwe hates empty gaps. He goes to the workbench, picks up an adjustable wrench and a little plastic watering can. He walks out, locks the shed, and tugs at the door handle 3 times, then goes down the little pathway between the houses, turns off by the last mailbox, and rings a doorbell. Anita opens the door. Uwe looks at her without a word. Sees Rune sitting there in his wheelchair, vacantly staring out of the window. It seems that's all he's done these last few years.
"Where have you got the radiators, then?" mutters Uwe.
Anita smiles, a surprised little smile, and nods with equally mixed eagerness and confusion.
"Oh, Uwe, that's dreadfully kind of you. If it's not too much trouble..."
Uwe steps into the hall without letting her finish what she's saying or removing his shoes.
Yeah, this crappy day is already ruined anyway.
Chapter 10. A man who was Uwe, and a house that Uwe built. A week after his 18th birthday, Uwe passed his driving test, responded to an advertisement, and walked 15 miles to buy his first own car, a blue Saab 93. He sold his dad's old Saab 92 to pay for it. It was only marginally newer, admittedly, and quite a run-down Saab 93 at that. But a man was not a proper man until he had bought his own car, felt Uwe. And so it was. It was a time of change in the country. People moved and found new jobs and bought televisions, and the newspapers started talking about a middle class. Uwe didn't quite know what this was, but he was well aware that he was not a part of it. The middle classes moved into new housing developments with straight walls and carefully trimmed lawns, and it soon grew clear to Uwe that his parental home stood in the way of progress, and if there was anything this middle class was not enamored of, it was whatever stood in the way of progress. Uwe received several letters from the council about what was called the redrawing of municipal boundaries. He didn't quite understand the content of these letters, but he understood that his parental home did not fit among the new-built houses on the street. The council notified him of their intention to force him to sell the land to them so the house could be demolished, and another built in its place. Uwe wasn't sure what it was that made him refuse, maybe because he didn't like the tone of that letter from the council, or because the house was all he had left of his family. Whatever the case, he parked his first very own car in the garden that evening and sat in the driver's seat for several hours, gazing at the house. It was, to be blunt, decrepit. His father's specialty had been machines, not building, and Uwe was not much better himself. These days he used only the kitchen and the little room leading off it, while the entire second floor was slowly being turned into a recreational stamping ground for mice. He watched the house from the car as if hoping that it might start repairing itself if he waited patiently enough. It lay exactly on the boundary between two municipal authorities, on a line on the map that would now be moved one way or the other. It was the remnant of an extinguished little village at the edge of the forest, next to the shining residential development into which people wearing suits had now moved with their families. The suits didn't like the lonely youth in the house due for demolition at the end of the street. The children were not allowed to play around Uwe's house. Suits preferred to live in the vicinity of other suits, Uwe had come to understand. He had nothing against that, of course, but they were the ones who had moved into his neighborhood, not the other way around. And so, filled with a kind of strange defiance that made Uwe's heart beat a little faster for the first time in years, he decided not to sell his house to the council. He decided to do the opposite. Repair it. Of course, he had no idea of how to do it. He didn't know a dovetail joint from a pot of potatoes. Realizing that his new working hours left him entirely free in the daytime, he went to a nearby construction site and applied for a job. He imagined this must be the best possible place to learn about building. And he didn't need much sleep, anyway. The only thing they could offer him was a laboring job, said the foreman. Uwe took it. So he spent his nights picking up litter on the line heading south out of town. Then, after 3 hours of sleep, he used what time remained to dart up and down the scaffolding, listening to the men in hard hats talking about construction techniques. One day a week he was free, and then he dragged sacks of cement and wooden beams back and forth for 18 hours at a stretch,
perspiring and lonely, demolishing and rebuilding the only thing his parents had left him apart from the Saab and his father's wristwatch. Uwe's muscles grew, and he was a fast learner. The foreman at the building site took a liking to the hard-working youth, and one Friday afternoon took Uwe to the pile of discarded planks, made to measure timber that had cracked and was due for burning.
"If I happen to look the other way and something you need goes walking, I'll assume you've burned it," said the foreman, and walked off.
Once the rumors of his house building had spread among his older colleagues, one or other of them occasionally asked Uwe about it. When he damaged the wall in the living room, a wiry colleague with wonky front teeth, after spending 20 minutes telling Uwe what an idiot he was for not knowing better from the start, taught him how to calculate the load-bearing parameters. When he laid the floor in the kitchen, a more heavy-built colleague with a missing little finger on one hand, after calling him a bonehead 36 times, showed him how to take proper measurements. One afternoon, as he was about to head home at the end of his shift, Uwe found a little toolbox full of used tools by his clothes. It came with a note that simply read, "To the puppy." Slowly, the house took shape, screw by screw and floorboard by floorboard. No one saw it, of course, but there was no need for anyone to see it. A job well done is a reward in its own right, as his father always used to say. He kept out of the way of his neighbors as much as he could. He knew they didn't like him, and he saw no reason to give them further ammunition. The only exception was an elderly man and his wife who lived next door to Uwe. This man was the only one on their whole street who did not wear a tie. Uwe had religiously fed the birds every other day since his father died. He only forgot to do it one morning. When the following morning he came out to compensate for his omission, he almost collided headfirst into the older man by the fence under the bird table. His neighbor gave him an insulted glance. He had bird seed in his hands. They did not say anything to one another. Uwe merely nodded, and the older man gave him a little nod back. Uwe went back into his house, and from that time on made sure he kept to his own days. They never spoke to one another, but one morning when the older man stepped onto his front step, Uwe was painting his fence. And when he was done with that, he also painted the other side of the fence. The older man didn't say anything about it, but when Uwe went past his kitchen window in the evening, they nodded at one another. And the next day there was a home-baked apple pie on Uwe's front step. Uwe had not eaten homemade apple pie since his mother died. Uwe received more letters from the council. They became increasingly threatening in their tone and displeased that he still hadn't contacted them about the sale of his property. In the end, he started throwing the letters away without even opening them. If they wanted his father's house, they could come here and try to take it, the same way Tom had tried to take that wallet from him all those years ago. A few mornings later, Uwe walked past the neighbor's house and saw the elderly man feeding the birds in the company of a little boy. A grandchild of his, Uwe realized. He watched them surreptitiously through the bedroom window. The way the older man and the boy spoke in low voices with each other, as if they were sharing some great secret, it reminded him of something. That night, he had his supper in the Saab. A few weeks later, Uwe drove home the last nail in his house, and when the sun rose over the horizon, he stood in the garden with his hands shoved into the pockets of his navy trousers, proudly surveying his work. He discovered that he liked houses. Maybe mostly because they were understandable. They could be calculated and drawn on paper. They did not leak if they were made watertight. They did not collapse if they were properly supported. Houses were fair. They gave you what you deserved, which unfortunately was more than one could say about people. And so the days went by. Uwe went to work and came home and had sausages and spuds. He never felt alone, despite his lack of company. Then one Sunday, as Uwe was moving some planks, a jovial man with a round face and an ill-fitting suit turned up at his gate. The sweat ran from his forehead, and he asked Uwe if there might be a glass of water of the cold variety going spare. Uwe saw no reason to deny him this, and while the man drank it by his gate, some small talk passed between them.
Or rather, it was mostly the man with the round face who did the talking. It turned out that he was very interested in houses. Apparently, he was in the midst of doing up his own house in another part of town. And somehow, the man with the round face managed to invite himself into Uva's kitchen for a cup of coffee. Obviously, Uva was not used to this kind of pushy behavior, but after an hour-long conversation about house building, he was prepared to admit to himself that it wasn't so unpleasant having a bit of company in the kitchen for a change. Just before the man left, he asked in passing about Uva's house insurance. Uva answered candidly that he'd never given it much thought. His father had not been very interested in insurance policies. The jovial man with the round face was filled with consternation, and he explained to Uva that it would be a veritable catastrophe for him if something happened to the house. After listening carefully to his many admonishments, Uva felt bound to agree with them. He had never given much thought to it until then, which made him feel rather stupid now. The man then asked if he might use the telephone. Uva said that would be fine. It turned out that his guest, grateful for a stranger's hospitality on a hot summer's day, had found a way of repaying his kindness. For it transpired that he actually worked for an insurance company, and was able to pull some strings to arrange an excellent quotation for Uva. Uva was skeptical at first. He asked again about the man's credentials, which he was happy to reiterate. He then spent a considerable amount of time negotiating a better price. "You're a tough businessman," said the man with the round face, with a laugh. Uva felt surprisingly proud when he heard this. "A tough businessman." The man then glanced at his watch, thanked Uva, and said he'd best be on his way. As he left, he gave Uva a piece of paper with his telephone number, and said that he'd very much like to come by another day and have some more coffee and talk some more about house renovation. This was the first time anyone had ever expressed a wish to be Uva's friend. Uva paid the man with the round face the full year's premium in cash. They shook hands. The man with the round face never contacted him again. Uva tried to call him on one occasion, but no one answered. He felt a quick stab of disappointment, but decided not to think about it again. At least when salesmen called from other insurance companies, he was able to say without any bad conscience that he was already insured, and that was something. Uva continued avoiding his neighbors. He didn't want any problems with them, but unfortunately the problems seemed to have decided to seek out Uva instead. A few weeks after his house repairs were finished, one of his suited neighbors was burgled. It was the second burglary in the area in a relatively short period. The suits got together early next morning to deliberate on that young rascal in the condemned house, who must have had something to do with it. They knew very well where he'd got the money for all that renovation. In the evening, someone stuck a note under Uva's door, on which was written, "Clear off if you know what's good for you." The night after that, a stone was thrown through his window. Uva picked up the stone and changed the glass in the window. He never confronted the suits, saw no purpose in it, but he wasn't going to move either. Early the next morning, he was woken by the smell of smoke. He was out of his bed in an instant. The first thing that came into his head was that whoever had thrown that stone had apparently not finished yet. On his way down the stairs, he instinctively grabbed a hammer. Not that Uva had ever been a violent man, but you could never be sure, he decided. He was wearing only his underpants when he stepped onto the front veranda. All that lugging of construction materials in the last months had turned Uva into an impressively muscular young man without him even noticing. His bare upper body and the hammer swinging in his clenched right fist made the group gathered in the street momentarily take their eyes off the fire and instinctively take a step back. And that was when Uva realized that it was not his house that was burning, but his neighbor's. The suits stood in the street, staring like deer into headlights. The elderly man emerged out of the smoke, his wife leaning on his arm. She was coughing terribly. When the elderly man handed her over to one of the suit's wives, and then turned back towards the fire, several of the suits cried out to him, telling him to leave it. It's too late. Wait for the fire brigade, they roared. The elderly man didn't listen. Burning material fell over the threshold as he tried to step inside into a sea of fire. Uva stood in the face of the wind by his gate and saw how scattered glowing balls had already set the dry grass alight between his house and the neighbors. For a few long, drawn-out seconds, he evaluated the situation as best he could. The fire would be all over his house in a few minutes if he didn't charge off to get the water hose at once. He saw the elderly man trying to push his way past an overturned bookcase on his way into the house. The suits shouted his name and tried to make him stop, but the elderly man's wife was screaming out another name, their grandchild. Uva rocked on his heels as he watched the embers stealing their way through the grass. In all honesty, he was probably not thinking so much about what he wanted to do, but about what his father would have done. And as soon as that thought had taken root, there was not much choice about it. He muttered, irritated, looking at his house a last time, instinctively calculating to himself how many hours it had taken to build it, and then he ran towards the fire. The house was so filled with thick, sticky smoke that it was like being struck in the face with a shovel. The elderly man struggled to move the fallen bookcase, which was blocking a door. Uva threw it aside as if it were made of paper and cleared a way up the stairs. By the time they emerged into the light of dawn, the elderly man was carrying the boy in his soot-covered arms. Uva had long, bleeding grazes across his chest and arms. The bystanders just ran around, panicking, screaming. The air was pierced by sirens. Uniformed firemen surrounded them. Still wearing only his underpants and with aching lungs, Uva saw the first flames climbing his own house. He charged across the lawn but was immediately stopped by a group of firemen. They were everywhere, all of a sudden. Refused to let him through. A man in a white shirt, some sort of chief fireman as Uva understood it, stood before him with his legs wide apart and explained that they couldn't let him try to extinguish the fire in his own house. It was much too dangerous. Unfortunately, the white shirt explained after that, the fire brigade could not put it out either until they had the appropriate permissions from the authorities. It turned out that because Uva's house now lay exactly on the municipal boundary, clearance from the command center was required on the shortwave radio before they could get to work. Permission had to be sought. Papers had to be stamped. "Rules are rules," the man in the white shirt explained in a monotone voice when Uva protested. Uva tore himself free and ran in fury towards the water hose, but it was futile. By the time the firemen got the all-clear signal, the house was already engulfed by fire. Uva stood in his garden and watched, helpless and in sorrow, as it burned. When a few hours later he stood in a telephone booth calling the insurance company, he learned that they had never heard of the jovial man with the round face. There was no valid insurance policy on the house. The woman from the insurance company sighed, impatiently explaining that swindlers often went from door to door claiming to be from their company, and that she hoped at least Uva hadn't given him any cash. Uva hung up and clenched his fist in his pocket. Chapter 11 A man called Uva, and a lanky one who can't open a window without falling off a ladder. It's 5:45, and the first proper snowfall of the year has laid itself like a cold blanket over the slumbering community of row houses. Uva unhooks his jacket and goes outside for his daily inspection. With equal surprise and dissatisfaction, he sees the cat sitting in the snow outside his door. It seems to have been sitting there all night. Uva slams the front door extra hard to scare it away. Apparently, it doesn't have the common sense to take fright. Instead, it just sits there in the snow, licking its stomach, utterly unconcerned. Uva doesn't like that sort of behavior in a cat. He shakes his head and plants his feet firmly on the ground. The cat gives him the briefest of glances, clearly uninterested, then goes back to licking itself. Uva waves his arms at it. The cat doesn't budge an inch.
"This is private land," says Uva.
When the cat still fails to give him any sort of acknowledgement, Uvo loses his patience and, in a sweeping movement, kicks one of his clogs towards it. Looking back, he couldn't swear that it wasn't intentional. His wife would have been furious if she'd seen it, of course. It doesn't make much difference, anyway. The clog flies in a smooth arc and passes a good yard and a half to the left of its intended target before bouncing softly against the side of the shed and landing in the snow. The cat looks nonchalantly first at the clog, and then at Uva. In the end, it stands up, strolls around the corner of Uva's shed, and disappears. Uva walks through the snow in his socks to fetch the clog. He glares at it as if he feels it should be ashamed of itself for not having a better sense of aim. Then he pulls himself together and goes on his inspection tour. Just because he's dying today doesn't mean that the vandals should be given free rein. When he comes back to his house, he pushes his way through the snow and opens the door to the shed. It smells of mineral spirits and mold in there, exactly as it should in a shed. He steps over the sob's summer tires and moves the jars of unsorted screws out of the way. Squeezes past the workbench, careful not to knock over the jars of mineral spirits with brushes in them. Lifts aside the garden chairs and the globe barbecue. Puts away the rim wrench and snatches up the snow shovel. Weighs it a bit in his hand the way one might do with a two-handed sword. Stands there in silence, scrutinizing it. When he comes out of the shed with a shovel, the cat is sitting in the snow again right outside his house. Uva glares in amazement at its audacity. Its fur is thawing out, dripping, or what remains of its fur. There are more bald patches than fur on that creature. It also has a long scar running along one eye, down across its nose. If cats have 9 lives, this one is quite clearly working its way through at least the 7th or 8th of them.
"Clear off," says Uva.
The cat gives him a judgmental stare, as if it's sitting on the decision-making side of the desk at a job interview. Uva grips the shovel, scoops up some snow, and throws it at the cat, which jumps out of the way and glares indignantly at him. Spits out a bit of snow, snorts, then turns around and pads off again, around the corner of Uva's shed. Uva puts his snow shovel to work. It takes him 15 minutes to free up the paving between the house and the shed. He works with care, straight lines, even edges. People don't shovel snow that way anymore. Nowadays, they just clear away. They use snow blowers and all sorts of things. Any old method will do, scattering snow all over the place. As if that was the only thing that mattered in life, pushing one's way forward. When he's done, he leans for a moment against the shovel in a snowdrift on the little pathway, balances his body weight on it, and watches the sun rising over the sleeping houses. He's been awake for most of the night, thinking of ways to die. He has even drawn some diagrams and charts to clarify the various methods. After carefully weighing up the pros and cons, he has accepted that what he's doing today has to be the best of bad alternatives. Admittedly, he doesn't like the fact that the sob will be left in neutral and use up a lot of expensive gas for no good reason afterwards, but it's simply a factor that he'll have to accept in order to get it done. He puts the snow shovel back in the shed and goes into the house. Puts on his good navy suit again. It will get stained and foul-smelling by the end of all this, but Uva has decided that his wife just has to go along with it, at least when he gets there. He has his breakfast and listens to the radio, washes up and wipes down the counter, then goes around the house checking the radiators, turns off all lights, checks that the coffee percolator is unplugged, puts on the blue jacket over his suit, then the clogs, and goes back into the shed. He returns with a long rolled-up plastic tube, locks the shed and the front door, tugs 3 times at each door handle, then goes down the little pathway between the houses. The white Skoda comes from the left and takes him by such surprise that he almost collapses in a snowdrift by the shed. Uva runs down the pathway in pursuit, shaking his fist.
"Can't you read, you bloody idiot?" he roars.
The driver, a slim man with a cigarette in his hand, seems to have heard him. When the Skoda turns off by the bike shed, their eyes meet through the side window. The man looks directly at Uwe and rolls down his window, lifts his eyebrows, disinterested.
"Motor vehicles prohibited,"
Uwe repeats, pointing at the sign where the very same message is written. He walks towards the Skoda with clenched fists. The man hangs his left arm out of the window and unhurriedly taps the ash off his cigarette. His blue eyes are completely unmoved. He looks at Uwe as one looks at an animal behind a fence. Devoid of aggression, totally indifferent. As if Uwe were something the man might wipe off with a damp cloth.
"Read the sign,"
says Uwe harshly as he gets closer, but the man has already rolled up his window. Uwe yells at the Skoda, but the man ignores him. He doesn't even pull away with the wheel spin and screaming tires. He simply rolls off toward the garages and then onward to the main road, as if Uwe's gesticulation was of no more consequence than a broken streetlight. Uwe stands rooted to the spot, so worked up that his fists are trembling. When the Skoda has disappeared, he turns around and walks back between the houses, so hurried that he almost stumbles over his own legs. Outside Rune and Anita's house, where the white Skoda has quite clearly been parked, are two cigarette butts on the ground. Uwe picks them up, as if they were clues in a high-level criminal case.
"Hello, Uwe,"
he hears Anita say, cautiously behind him. Uwe turns towards her. She is standing on the step, wrapped in a gray cardigan. It looks as if it's trying to grab hold of her body, like two hands, clutching a wet bar of soap.
Yeah, hello, answers Uwe.
"He was from the council," she says, with a nod in the direction of which the Skoda drove off.
"Vehicles are prohibited in this area," says Uwe.
She nods cautiously again.
"He said he has special permission from the council to drive to the house."
"He doesn't have any bloody—"
Uwe begins, then stops himself and clamps his jaws around the words. Anita's lips are trembling.
"They want to take Rune away from me," she says.
Uwe nods without answering. He is still holding the plastic tube in his hand. He pushes his other clenched fist into his pocket. For a moment, he thinks about saying something, but then he looks down, turns around, and leaves. He's already gone several yards when he realizes that he has the cigarette butts in his pocket, but by then it's too late to do anything about it. Blonde Weed is standing in the street. Mutt starts barking hysterically as soon as it catches sight of Uwe. The door to the house behind them is open, and Uwe assumes they are standing there, waiting for that thing known as Anders. Mutt has something like fur in its mouth. Its owner grins with satisfaction. Uwe stares at her as he goes past. She doesn't avert her eyes. Her grin gets even broader, as if she's grinning at Uva's expense. When he passes between his house and that of the lanky one and pregnant woman, he sees the lanky one standing in the doorway.
"Hi there, Uwe,"
he calls out inanely. Uwe sees his ladder leaning up against the lanky one's house. The lanky one waves cheerfully. Apparently, he's got up early today, or at least early by the standard of IT consultants. Uwe can see that he's holding a blunt silver dinner knife in one hand, and he realizes he's most likely intending to use it to lever the jammed upstairs window. Uwe's ladder, which the lanky one is clearly about to scale, has been shoved at an angle into a deep snowdrift.
"Have a good day."
Yeah,
answers Uwe without turning around as he trudges past. Mutt is outside that Anders thing's house, barking furiously. Out of the corner of his eye, Uwe sees the weed still standing there with a scorching smile in his direction. It disturbs Uwe. He doesn't quite know the reason for it, but he feels a disturbance in his bones. As he walks up between the houses, past the bicycle shed and into the parking area, he reluctantly admits to himself that he's walking around looking for the cat, but he can't seem to find it anywhere. He opens his garage door, unlocks the Saab, and then stands there,
his hands in his pockets, for what must be an excess of a half hour. He doesn't